I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. We all know that exercise is good for our health, but most of us do not work out. We don't go to the gym or have a running regimen or make sure we work up a good sweat a couple of times a week. In fact, about half of Americans do not meet the minimal weekly fitness recommendations. Why is that? Why do so many of us dread and avoid physical exertion? Our guest, Harvard human evolutionary biologist Daniel Lieberman, argues in his new book, Exercised, that human beings never evolved to exercise. Our early ancestors conserved their energy for basic survival, for finding food and having babies. But we are more sedentary now. We don't have to walk miles hunting and gathering. So how do we motivate ourselves to be more active? Daniel Lieberman joins us to talk about the science of physical fitness, his research in Kenya with indigenous people, the kind of motivation that overcomes resistance to exercise, and he dispels some myths, including that running is bad for your knees and that sitting is the new smoking. Daniel Lieberman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, you're very welcome. And, you know, all interviews today begin with questions about the pandemic. That's just the world we live in. And I'm curious about, did the pandemic change how much you exercised or how active you have been in the last year?
Oh, gosh. I'm no exception.
Yes.
I mean, I have I have an iPhone that keeps track of my daily step counts. And although I love to run and I've continued to run, all the other sort of non-exercise physical activity that I normally do has definitely been curtailed by about 50%, according to the iPhone. I mean, I just, you know, I don't walk to work. I don't climb up the stairs into my office. I mean, there's just so many things I don't do because I'm basically confined to home like everybody else.
Some people referred to COVID-19 as the 19 pounds that people have gained in the last year.
Yeah. There's a fair amount of data that people have gained a fair amount of weight from some combination of diet and inactivity, yeah.
What is the difference between, as you said, that, you know, a step counter, which, you know, if we're doing, I guess, being active, we can get to 10,000 steps a day. What's the difference between activity and actually doing exercise?
Well, that's the heart of the question. So thanks for asking
sure
that. So basically, you know, physical activity is just moving, right? You know, if I walk to work or you know, go to the supermarket and schlep stuff around the supermarket or whatever, right? To carry things out to the trash out, that's all physical activity. But exercise is a particular kind of physical activity. It's discretionary, voluntary, often planned physical activity for the sake of health and fitness. So it's going to the gym. It's going for a run. It's you know, it's lifting weights. It's getting on a treadmill. That's exercise.
What though? I mean, take us inside the body. So what? I mean, I think we sort of know what's happening there. But why does that give us the kind of benefit that exercise can do?
Well, we don't know all the reasons why physical activity, including exercise, is healthy, but the main reasons are that it's a stress, right? But it's a good stress. So when you say, let's just imagine you decide to climb a mountain today, or
sure,
or go for a run, or I don't know, swim across the English Channel, or whatever it is you want to do.
Why not?
Right? When you do that, you're gonna generate a wide range of stresses. As you use more energy, your mitochondria, which are the little organelles in every cell that are kind of powerhouse your cells, they're the little battery providers, right? They're gonna produce things called reactive oxygen species. They're little molecules that cause damage, right? You're going to produce byproducts of metabolism, like lactic acid. You're going to create little tears in your muscle and cracks in your bone, and you're going to generate heat. You're going to do every single part of your body is going to get stressed a little bit. But because that's a normal stress, right, and we evolved to deal with it, and we always evolved to be physically active, your body is also going to turn on all kinds of mechanisms to counter those stresses. Right. You're going to produce antioxidants. You're going to repair the DNA. You're going to produce enzymes that repair your DNA. You're going to strengthen your muscles. You're going to fix your bones. Everything you can think of, we have responses to do that, and all of that turns out to be a net benefit because we don't turn on those mechanisms as much in the absence of physical activity. So because nobody in the past ever was inactive, so we never evolved alternative ways to to turn on all these mechanisms which prevent us from senescing, from getting older, from deteriorating. So that's half the question. I'm sorry, this is a long answer. I apologize.
No, that's okay.
Because it's a big
question. No, it is. Yeah, no, go ahead. It is the kind of heart of the book, but go ahead.
Yeah. So the stresses are important, and the responses to those stresses are important. But the other thing that's important is that you also just kind of use up energy, and you change your metabolism. So if you just sit around all day long, your body naturally just, you know, doesn't know what to do, right? It's you have more circulating fats and sugars in your bloodstream. You end up producing higher levels of women end up producing higher levels of estrogen and progesterone, which increase risk for say breast cancer, which is one of the reasons why exercise is so important for reducing breast cancer risk in women, because our bodies are evolved to essentially turn energy into babies. That's basically what we're here on this planet for, and so we naturally, when we have a little extra energy, natural selection wants us to shunt that energy towards reproduction, and the reproduction today, the extra energy we shunt towards reproduction isn't always healthy. So we store extra fat, and we increase our hormone levels, and of course, all that extra fat, we all know what that does. It causes a wide range of problems.
Sure, diabetes, health problems, and on from there. Let me then just ask you about some of the research that you have done in Kenya, frankly, in other parts of the world, looking at these hunter-gatherer societies. So it is a bit of a window into our past and how our ancient ancestors, such as they were, how active they were, how they lived their lives. What have you learned?
Well, my field work is actually mostly with farmers, but I have gone and visited and observed hunter-gatherers in various parts of the world. But my research team, we actually mostly work on subsistence farmers. But the data on hunter-gatherers, so I don't want to take credit for other people's data, but gotcha. But the data that's been collected on hunter-gatherers shows that are still alive today. So they, as you say, they offer kind of a window on what our lives used to be like before agriculture. And remember, agriculture was invented only 600 generations ago. So until recently, everybody was a hunter-gatherer. And it turns out that hunter-gatherers, we have this idea that they're like super strong, kind of super athletes who go out and either do all kinds of amazing physical activities. They're fit and strong, but they're not crazy fit. They're not crazy strong. They turn out, they average about 2 to 3 hours of moderate to vigorous physical activity every day. They're reasonably strong, but they're not super strong. But the thing is that they keep it up throughout life. You know, average hunter-gatherer woman walks about 5 miles a day. The average hunter-gatherer man walks about net 9 miles a day, every day. There are no weekends. There's no holidays. And importantly, there's no retirement. So they keep that up throughout their life. And it's that continued physical activity as we age that's super important, because the older we get, the more potent physical activity is in terms of helping preserve health.
So again, this differentiation between activity and exercise. So they don't exercise, the
no,
way we might
I've never
recognize
seen
that.
Anybody in any of these places do what I do.
Right.
Like sometimes I get up in the morning and go for a run. And they think I'm the stupidest person on the planet. I mean, they laugh at me. They just like, why would anybody do that, right? And the reason is that they're energy limited, and they're already very physically active. So, if we live in a very strange world today where we have access to super abundant amounts of energy. In fact, we pay extra money for food that has less energy in it, right? And that's, that never happened until very recently. And so if you're always struggling to get enough food, It really isn't a good idea to go for a 5 mile run in the morning. Like I just did, I just went for a 5 mile run, so I burned about 500 calories to do that 5 mile run. Right. And if you're calorie limited, that's 500 calories that you don't have to help take care of your body and to reproduce and to do all the other things that natural selection cares about. So people used to be physically active for two reasons and two reasons only. They were active when it was necessary. And they were active when it was socially rewarding, when it was rewarding in some way, like dancing, for example, which is obviously every culture has dancing, and dancing is socially important, or playing when you're young to develop skills and 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 and, 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 and capacities, right? So people do things that we sometimes think of as exercise, but they don't think of them as exercise.
Which raises a whole host of questions, really, about evolution and natural selection and, frankly, survival of the fittest. I mean, we know that we pay a pretty steep price for probably more than for the foods we eat combined with a more sedentary lifestyle. Is that, I mean, how should we think of survival of the fittest in the year 2021?
Well, yeah, so what we have today is an incredible increase in what we call mismatch diseases. So mismatch diseases are diseases that illnesses and conditions that we get because our bodies aren't really well adapted for the sort of modern environments in which we now live. Because we evolved to be very active. We evolved to eat an unprocessed diet without a lot of sugar. We evolved to do all kinds of things, right? And all of a sudden we're in this, in the blink of an eye, we've invented all kinds of machines that make it so that we no longer have to do any work. I mean, I don't have to brush my teeth anymore. I can have an electric toothbrush.
You've got a machine that does that, right?
I have, when I go shopping, I have a cart that carries everything. I don't have to carry anything anymore. I don't have to walk. I don't have to climb stairs. I don't have to do anything, actually, if I didn't want to. We've also got, super abundant food that we never had access to. Sugar in quantities that hunter-gatherers can only dream of, right? And so the result is that we get various kinds of illnesses. And so in the modern world, we have to do something that we never had to do in the old days, which is we had to choose to be physically active for no reason other than right. It's healthy. We have to choose not to eat foods that otherwise we would have craved and loved because they were rare and important. And it's really hard to make those choices. And I think one of the reason I called the book Exercised is that we make people exercised about exercise. We make them feel bad. We make them feel ashamed. We make them feel like they're lazy, that there's something wrong with them when they want to avoid unnecessary physical activity. But that's just normal. That's a normal instinct. And I think the first step in helping us do better and help us choose without haranguing each other and without, coercing each other to be physically active is to understand that those inclinations are natural. A good example is that I often use is if you're ever in an airport or a subway stop or a mall, or remember all those places we used to go to? And there's a stairway next to an escalator, right? And there's a little voice in your head which always says, take the escalator, right? And even though no escalators existed in the Stone Age, that's just a basic instinct to save unnecessary energy, right? And that's, we shouldn't feel bad about that little voice. We should understand it and think about it and then decide if we want to override it.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. I want to pick up on a bunch of things that you just said, Daniel Lieberman. Also to our listeners, talking with Daniel Lieberman, he is a human evolutionary biologist at Harvard University, and he's the author of a book titled Exercised, and it's subtitled Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. You can join us, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. Much more after the short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with evolutionary biologist Daniel Lieberman about his new book. It is called Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. And you can join us, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Daniel, let me pick up on something you said right before the break. So we're at this sort of strange juncture in I guess, human evolution in that we don't want to we resist exercising, largely speaking, but our body needs to be active in order for us to stay fit, be healthy, and survive. Are we in sort of a war with ourselves, evolutionarily speaking?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say we're at war with ourselves, but we are in a very strange a time and a very strange point in our evolutionary history where we have to, we have to choose to do things that aren't really sort of instinctive. There are many of these sorts of things. I mean, look, think about reading, right? I mean, we all believe that reading is normal and natural and everybody should be reading. But, nobody read until a few thousand years ago. Nobody on the planet read. And until a few generations ago, universal literacy was something that people just dreamed about, right? So So there's all kinds of ways in which our world has changed. And obviously, physical activity is a very major one. I mean, we spend hundreds of calories less per day being physically active today, the average American, than our great-grandparents. And that has, of course, enormous effects on not only our long-term health, but also our short-term immediate mental health. Physical activity is extremely important for a wide variety of aspects of health and well-being, and I mean, everybody knows that. And the problem is that we haven't really come up with any good ways to help people, many people, to overcome it. So about 20% of Americans meet standard World Health Organization recommendations, which is 150 minutes a week of sort of moderate exercise. But the other 80% fail to reach those levels, and in fact, 50% of Americans basically don't exercise at all. And so we're obviously the kind of current system where we medicalize it, we commodify it, commercialize it, by any stretch of the imagination, it's just not working.
Years ago, I signed up at a local gym, became a member, and I would drive by it every day coming home from work, and then I would just keep going. I would not turn into the driveway. And I kept asking myself, I just paid X number of dollars to go and exercise, and yet I cannot make myself do it. There is a sort of, we've been talking about kind of a physical resistance, but it also feels mental on top of that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, and then you probably felt bad about yourself, right?
Terrible.
But it's normal. I mean, that instinct is universal. I mean, look, even people who exercise a lot struggle to get out the door. I mean, I'm no different, right? I'm pretty good at exercising, but I find it very hard to motivate myself. But I've learned all kinds of tricks. I have a running buddy, and we often meet in the morning. And I don't, the day before when we agreed to meet, it sounds fine and dandy, and then 6 a.m, it's like, I don't want to be out there. I want to stay in bed. But unfortunately, I'm stuck now because, he's going to be on the corner waiting for me, and he'll be irritated if I'm not there at 6. So I put on my shorts and shirt and whatever, and I head out there, and I'm usually kind of grumpy. I sign up for races, and it's not that I love the races, but signing up for the race kind of forces me to train because I don't want to be humiliated on race day. And of course, because I study this stuff and teach about this stuff, I have another incentive, which a lot of other people don't have, which is that for example, in my office is on the fifth floor of a beautiful old Victorian building, and it's 5 really long flights of stairs to get up to my office. Every day I go into the building, I would like to take the elevator. Every day, no question about it. And I have this little mental battle, and the reason I mostly take the stairs is that if anybody catches me on the elevator, they'll know they'll brand me correctly as a hypocrite.
You're a liar, right? And a hypocrite, right?
Right. So I kind of, it forces me to take the stairs. And I'm usually glad I took the stairs at the end. I'm glad that I went for that run. But it's hard to motivate yourself, and that's just normal.
Sure. Well, and something you write near the beginning of your book, you say, if you're a typical person who barely exercises, it would take you just an hour or two of walking per day to be as physically active as a hunter-gatherer. So that, on the other hand, that seems kind of doable for most people.
It is, and that's part of the problem with the way we've commercialized and prescribed exercise. People feel like they have to, like, get out of bed and, run an ultra-marathon, and if they don't, there's something wrong with them, right? But it turns out that if you're physically inactive and you're struggling to get fit, it turns out if you just did an hour a week, right? 8 minutes a day, you can just that we've has been shown to have enormous benefits. It can lower, an hour a week of physical activity can lower moderate to vigorous, so like a brisk walk, for example, can lower the average person's relative risk of mortality by about 30%. I mean, that's substantial. So any bit that you do helps, right? And if you do 150 minutes a week, you lower that to about 50% mortality rate, and more has some additional benefits. I mean, eventually it tails off. So you don't have to, swim the English Channel, climb Mount Everest, run an ultra marathon. You can just climbing the stairs in your building on a regular basis or go walking places, all of that will have some benefit.
And if we're doing nothing or resting, are we still being physically active? Is there something still for human beings, something that our body is doing, even if we look like we're doing nothing?
Yes. So that's one of the interesting things about metabolism, right? So about, you know, for the typical sort of reasonably active person, about 2/3 of the calories that she or he is spending is being spent on just taking care of your body at rest. We call that your resting energy expenditure or your basal metabolism. So, you know, for me, like, that would be about 1,600 calories a day. I'm a sort of, you know, typical male American, right? And you know, that's just paying for everything. It's paying for your brain. It's paying for, you know, keeping all the tissues in your body alive, you know, replacing the cells in your gut, all that kind of stuff, your fingernails growing, you know, all those sorts of things cost energy. Your immune system, obviously. And you know, that's pretty expensive. And that's one of the reasons why we evolved, you know, to take it easy when it's possible, when it's necessary, because anytime you spend energy on something else, right, you have to take it away from another function, right? Unless you make it up with eating more, with more calories. And until recently, that was, you know, there were 7-Elevens on every corner and all that sort of stuff. So it was hard for people to make up the calories they spent on physical activity. So they avoided it.
Well, let's talk about sitting. And again, going back to the hunter-gatherers, you write, based on research, that looking at the hunter-gatherer societies of today, they sit about 10 hours a day. That's a lot of sitting. But I have a feeling that the way they sit is different from how you and I sit.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the ways which we make people exercised about physical activity is we tell them, you know, we kind of exaggerate stuff. We're afraid to tell people the truth, right? One of the exaggerations out there is that sitting is the new smoking. And, you know, right, a lot of people are pretty skeptical of that statement, right? I mean, you know, a chair is not like a cigarette. It's not like a toxin you're inhaling, right? But we've all been made really scared of sitting, right? And yet, you know, I've spent a lot of time in various parts of the world. I've been very lucky to observe and participate and measure people in different cultures. And they sit all the time. You know, you walk into a hunter-gatherer camp, everybody's sitting, right? And it turns out actually former students of mine put some sensors on a bunch of hunter-gatherers and found that they averaged about 10 hours a day, which is basically the same as most Americans. And they're fine, right? And it turns out, if you look at the epidemiological literature, there's two kinds of sitting. There's sitting that you do at work, and there's sitting you do at leisure. And it turns out that work-time sitting is actually not that much associated with negative health outcomes. It's leisure time sitting. So if you basically sit all day long and then you go home and then sit all evening long and you sit in your car to get to work and in other words, if you never do any physical activity, well, of course, then you're risking some negative health. But if you sit a fair amount of the day but also manage to do some physical activity, that's fine. So that's one issue. The other is that there's different kinds of sitting. And it turns out that hunter-gatherers and, you know, people who don't have chairs with backrests, you know, the backrests in our chairs used to be incredibly rare. It's only until the mid-19th century that cheap mass-produced chairs with backrests enabled everybody to sort of sit comfortably without having to use their back muscles. But so until recently, people sat on the ground or on stools or benches, and they had to use muscles all the time just to kind of keep their body up. And that kind of active sitting turns out to have some benefits. And in addition, people didn't sit for such long bouts, right? So the average American sits for like 40 minutes at a time between getting up to, you know, go to the bathroom or get a cup of tea or whatever. But in non-industrial societies, people get up about every 15 minutes.
Wow.
And that turns out to have all kinds of health benefits.
And just even getting up and going to the bathroom or just taking a quick stretch, that is good in terms of, and that is activity, right? Your body responds.
It is. It kind of like, it's like turning on your car engine, even if you're not driving anywhere. It's like turning on the machinery of your body. It uses up some of the sugar in your bloodstream. It uses up some of the fats in your blood. It turns on various genes in your cells that do good things. It's just kind of waking your body up, keeping it from going completely to sleep. And so that kind of active sitting turns out to be really beneficial.
Interesting. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Daniel Lieberman. He's got a new book. It's called Exercised, with a D on the end, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. He's a human evolutionary biologist at Harvard University, and we're talking about the really fascinating both research and observations in his book. And again, you can join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me just read a couple of questions. One from Bill. He says, people talk about a runner's high. What exactly is that? I don't get it when I run. Do we know why some people get it and others don't? As a fellow runner, Daniel Lieberman, do you get a runner's high?
I'm lucky enough that I do, but you know, you have to go a pretty decent distance. For me, it takes a good 2 hours of running for me to get a runner's high. Wow. And so we used to think runner's high were, it's a great question, and we used to think that runner's high was caused by sort of endogenous opioids. So our bodies produce all kinds of pain-killing medicines, right? You know, just like the opioids that are causing that horrible epidemic in the country. There are natural ones our bodies produce. And so that's why you can sometimes, you know, go for a long walk and come back and you realize you had this incredible blister, right? But you didn't realize you had it, you know, for the last few hours. That's because of the opioids kind of blunt the pain. But it turns out the opioids aren't really the cause of the runner's high. It's that our brains actually synthesize molecules called endocannabinoids. They're the same stuff that's in marijuana. And in fact, we upregulate the receptors for those things too. But it takes a long time and a fair amount of activity to get you know, to cause the brain to do that. But the result is a true runner's high. It makes you high. I mean, you know, and I think the reason for that is that it makes us, you know, I think we evolved to do these long runs in order to hunt. And hunters, when they're doing that, are tracking and they're, you know, they're using cues, right? And the high exaggerates your sensory input, right? You know, your sounds, the birds' sounds become more clear. The blue is bluer. You know, you have this heightened sensory awareness, and I think the runner's high is an adaptation to help us be alert and active and aware of our environment when we're hunting. But that's just a hypothesis. I can't test that. I can't prove that.
Sure, no. And I'm thinking about triathletes, you know, and I know you wrote about that. You have observed them, you know, doing these Herculean levels of activity and exercise. I think that is that sort of part of what keeps them going?
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, I've never done a triathlon, at least a full. But again, we never evolved to do that kind of stuff, you know. I mean, our ancestors did things called persistence hunting, which is, you know, it's usually like, you know, half marathon of running plus some walking, you know, and they do get into a kind of trance state, right? Sometimes, and try to imagine themselves being the animal, and you know, observing all the nature around them. And I think that's an important part out there. And we all know that when you're physically active, especially outdoors, I mean, all kinds of good stuff happens, right? You turn on, I mean, the runner's high is the extreme, but even going for a walk outside, your brain produces dopamine and serotonin and epinephrine and growth hormone and all kinds of stuff that improves your mood. And it's one of the reasons why physical activity is so important for mental health. And it has such an important immediate benefit for mental health. And if, you know, we often talk about people being exercising because it's important, you know, to prevent heart disease and cancer and all that, all of which is true. But there are also just immediate benefits. And I think during the pandemic, I think, you know, we've all become much more aware of that.
Yes, indeed. Sarah asks, how healthy is a stand-up desk or standing in place to do a task? Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, interestingly enough, there's really no good data on that. I mean, if you're trying to lose weight, you're really not going to lose weight with a standing desk or you know, all that sort of stuff. But it's certainly not bad. It's not exercise either, though. Let's not pretend that a standing desk is exercise. But you know,
is it an activity though? I mean, because you are at least standing and not sitting, but
I would call it a very light activity. But you know, it's a bit like active sitting, right? You know, you're going to be using some muscles as you stabilize your body. You're going to be using some leg muscles, some back muscles. So It's probably good, but we actually, to be honest, we don't have any really good data yet on the health benefits of standing desks. So I think if you like to do it, you should go ahead and do it. And I have a standing desk, which I use sometimes, but also sometimes I sit when I write. And, you know, it's, you know, there's no simple prescription. There's no simple solution.
Let me pick up on the running question, since you are a runner, and I am not, and I see them in my neighborhood. I see them running on hard sidewalks and the road as well. You say one of the myths is that running really destroys or hurts people's knees, and you're saying, you know, we just can't say that yet. Expand on that for us.
Well, you know, we have this... Among the most pernicious myths about exercise is that exercise is like you're like driving your car and causes like wear and tear on your body. And the most common wear and tear people are worried about is knees. And it is true that the most common site of injury for runners is their knees. But you should be happy to know that the people you see running around in your neighborhood, or those of you who are listening who run, there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever. In fact, evidence to the contrary that running causes arthritis, which is the wear and tear in your knees. It doesn't cause you to wear away the cartilage in your knees. In fact, if anything, there's a lot of evidence that running is actually really good for the cartilage in your joints. It actually causes our joints to kind of maintain themselves and repair themselves and stay in good shape. The other kinds of injuries that people are getting from running, I think, are caused by other factors. And I think the chief one is that I don't think people know how to run anymore. I think running is a skill, just like throwing and climbing and swimming, and that we don't learn the skill of running anymore. And a lot of people run really poorly. We're enabled to run poorly because we have these fancy schmancy cushioned running shoes that kind of enable you to land really hard on your heels, for example. And I think if we learned to run better and also had some basic muscular strength, that would really, the evidence is that would help prevent a lot of injuries.
Well, let's take another short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Daniel Lieberman, and he's got a new book. It's called Exercise. Much more after the short break, and we'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Daniel Lieberman. He is a human evolutionary biologist at Harvard University, and he's got a new book. It's called Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. Talking about sort of why we've emotionally, physically, mentally resist exercise based in part on our evolution about conserving energy, but why we need to overcome some of that because, of course, exercise is good for us. It's an interesting human conundrum. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Daniel, before the break, you were saying, you know, for runners, they buy fancy schmancy shoes, and a lot of people don't know how to run anymore. And to be honest with you, I've seen runners, and I just look at them running, and I think you are hurting yourself because it just looks painful, and their body just seems out of whack. But I also was thinking about children, you know, toddlers and babies, and how natural it is for them to be so physical and active and explore the world with their body.
Yeah, well, you know, it's an instinct, right? And play is something that all animals do, and humans are no exception. And there are only a few species that continue to play as adults. Dogs are one of them, and humans are another of them. And play, of course, plays such an important role in our development. Play is how we not only learn, social skills. We learn not to, you know, somebody scores a goal on you, you don't hit them, you know. But play also helps you develop capacities to be a, you know, a good functioning adult, to walk and run and do all the other sort of tasks that people used to do, fighting as well. And so one of the most heartbreaking things about our world today is that children are doing less play, physical play. There's less physical education in schools. A lot of it's also getting more and more directed towards sports, which is very focused and you know, goal-oriented and sometimes, and often in teams, you know, kids who aren't really good to spend a lot of their time sitting on the bench. That was certainly my experience when I was a kid. So, you know, we should, you know, and that's important also for adults. I mean, again, remember the principle we talked about earlier, which is we evolved to be physically active for two reasons, when it was necessary or rewarding. And I think that the trick in the modern world is to make it both necessary and rewarding. And to make it rewarding, you've got to make it fun. And to me, that's usually social, you know, doing stuff with friends, you know, going dancing, you know, we really need to, as a society, find new ways to help people have fun being physically active.
You write about and frankly complain about people you called exorcists, and these are of course the, you know, the shaming, the blaming, the nagging, the people who, you know, shake their fingers at a slothful human beings. Where do you think that comes from, first of all?
Gosh, well, there's a lot of virtue signaling out there, you know, like true. People with the 26.2 mile, you know, 26.2 bumper stickers, and the people who brag about, you know, how much weight they lifted in the gym, etc. And you know, on the one hand, they're enthusiastic about what they do, and that's fine. But I think we need to be compassionate with each other, right? About people's instincts, and you know, most people who are. Just as most people who are struggling with their weight, you know, they're not at fault, and they don't want to be overweight. But also, there's nothing bad about them as human beings. And I think we need to remember the same thing about physical activity. People who are unfit, struggling to be active. There's nothing wrong with them, and there's nothing. They're not immoral, and they're not lazy, and they're not. You know, we need to be compassionate. And I think exorcists, people who nag and brag about exorcists, often forget that, and they're judgmental and. And, you know, we don't get anywhere by being judgmental.
John asks, and this is going back to endorphins. He says, I consider myself an endorphin addict. Can people get addicted to the high that comes from exercise? What do you think?
Yeah. So the main addiction for physical activity, just like with other addictive behaviors, is dopamine. So dopamine is like the reward molecule in our brain. We produce it when we do all kinds of things, when we eat really good food, when we have sex, when we exercise it, and it says do that again, right? And then we have these receptors that are then hungry and they're waiting for their dopamine hit. And if we don't exercise or eat food or whatever, we don't get that reward. And it's a major benefit. In some ways of being active, but it's also a cost, because when, you know, anybody who's really active and then they, you know, have a few days where they can't be active, they're, we all know that feeling. You're kind of crabby and you're up anxious and you're a little tense and you're, you know, it's because your dopamine receptors are screaming for their hit. And it's one of the ways in which we you know, this whole system works. But the problem is, right, is that dopamine isn't so good about getting us out the door. It's good for rewarding us after we do get out the door, and it's hard.
Yeah. Here's Terry, who says, I like to exercise when there's a social component to it. Is there anything in our evolution that explains that? And Daniel, you said you have a running buddy, and so that both motivates you, but then you get to hang with your friend for an hour or two.
What a wonderful question. And I love it because it's so true. I mean, when people were physically active, for most of our evolutionary history, we did it in groups, right? When women in the Hadza, you know, the hunter-gatherer groups I've gone out with, and when they go out to gather, they go out in a group. There's a whole bunch of them, and they're all gossiping and chatting, and they sit down and they dig up tubers and underground storage organs, and they're all chatting and gossiping, and they're having a great time, and their kids are around, and then they walk home together. When men go hunting, they often go in groups, and they, you know, they chat and they gossip and they enjoy each other's friendships. I mean, people have been being physically active with each other for millions of years, I think, and it's been a social thing. And so that's one of the weird things about, you know, people who. You know, sometimes I do this I run, and sometimes when it's really bad, I have to go on a treadmill. But I find the treadmill one of the most horrible, you know, unpleasant.
I wanted to ask you about the treadmill.
Things on the planet, right? It's isolating. It's lonely. It's boring. You know, it's like taking cod liver oil. It's like medicine, right? And that, actually, throughout the book, I make fun of treadmills because it's like the apotheosis of exercise. So You know, and people do manage to do it, and they usually do it by listening. Maybe there are people listening to this right now on a treadmill, right? We listen to podcasts, we watch something, et cetera, kind of to make it tolerable. And that's like a substitute for doing it with a friend. But there's no substitute for going out for a run with a bunch of folks and chatting and gossiping. And, you know, there's nothing like a walk with friends. That's just a wonderful. And also you get the benefit of a support, right? You know, when it gets tough, we help each other and keep going. You know, you can do it. Or, you know, I'm so sorry. You have a side stitch or whatever, right? That we help each other, and that's you can't underestimate how important that is.
Just one quick treadmill question, because you do write about it in this book that its beginnings, it was some kind of Victorian torture device. True?
Yeah. So, yeah, treadmills, like early treadmills, Romans had them, for example. Of course, enslaved people would have to work on them, right, to power mills. But the kind of the treadmill that you and I think about, its origins lie in the Victorian era. There's a fellow named William Cubitt who invented it to punish prisoners in English prisoners, like, you know, debtors' prisons and things like that, too. Because, you know, you didn't want people to be enjoying themselves and relaxing in prison, right? So they created these treadmills to have people trudge for hours and hours of the day on these big slats to make their lives miserable. And I think that's really very, very metaphorical for the current treadmill that, you know, I mean, I find it a form of torture, too.
Interesting. Well, let me ask you about sleep, because there are a number of myths that you bust in this book. And one is that we all need to get our, you know, 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep every single night. And you're saying not so fast.
Yeah. So I got really interested in sleep. It's not my expertise, but I was interested in the question of, you know, if they tell us we should sit less, how come they're constantly telling us we should sleep more? So I started, you know, delving into the literature. And it turns out that, you know, we have this idea that in the modern world with electricity and iPhones and television and all the other things we have, right, that we sleep less than our ancestors used to do. But people have gone out into the, you know, I've slept in hunter-gatherer camps, and people seem to be up all the time. Like, I go to bed and they're still awake, and I wake up and everybody's up, and I'm like, what are you guys doing, right? And it turns out that, you know, people in these societies without any electricity or cell phones or TV or any of that sort of stuff, they don't sleep 8 hours. In fact, they sleep less than, you know, they sleep about six to seven hours is kind of average. And in fact, I think this is probably has really ancient roots. So there's actually no evidence that people used to sleep 8 hours. Furthermore, when you look at the epidemiological literature, it turns out that the amount you sleep, again, measured, not self-reported, because nobody really knows how much they sleep.
No,
right?
I was going to say,
asleep,
yeah.
Right? How can you know?
Right.
But if you actually use sensors to measure how much you sleep against your health outcome, it turns out that 7 hours turns out to be optimal for the average person. Of course, there's a lot of variation, right? So I don't want to discount the importance of getting enough sleep. So people who don't get enough sleep do suffer from a wide range of health issues. So sleep is important, but let's not like make people stressed about 8 hours. So if you sleep 7 hours last night, which is what I typically sleep actually, and you feel fine, don't feel like you're cheating yourself. You're actually a completely normal human being, and there's no evidence that you're doing yourself any harm. And if you sleep 8 hours, that's fine. And if you sleep 6 hours and you're happy, that's probably fine. If you're getting less, you know, you might want to, you know, think about whether or not you're getting enough sleep and do something about it. But the worst way to help people get more sleep is to make them stressed about it. Because what does stress do? Stress, you know, arouses you and keeps you from sleeping. And it's stress. It's cortisol, which is the primary reason people have trouble sleeping. They have psychosocial stress, and if you make them stressed about sleep, that's not going to help. And it creates a vicious circle.
Absolutely. Let me read Doris's question. She asks, I find competition in exercise and swimming or tennis as a good motivator. What role does competition have in exercise in motivating us? How does it fit in with our evolution as well?
Well, that's a wonderful question. I mean, I think competition in the sense of play has always been important, right? Kids play, right? Who can throw the best or the farthest and who can run the fastest and all that. I mean, you know, kids play, and one of the ways they play is to compete. And so it can be a motivator. But it also has a kind of a dark side too. I think, especially when it gets to elite sports, I think one of the arguments in my book is that are, you know, we've commercialized exercise, and one of the ways we've commercialized it is through professional sports. And I think we pay so much attention to these amazing elite athletes, and I enjoy, you know, elite, you know, professional sports as much as anybody else, but let's not pretend that they have much to do with you and me, right? You know, I mean, you know, the world's fastest marathoners, for example, I'm a runner, right? So the world's fastest marathoners can run, you know, a 440 mile for 26 miles. I can't run 1 mile at 440. I mean, no way. And you know, that can be kind of deflating. So I think, you know, finding the right kind of competition that's rewarding and fun and makes you feel good is great, but it's not a one size fits all. And for some people, it's off-putting. You know, I have lots of friends who find competition unpleasant because they're insecure and they don't feel good about it. And so we need to really make sure, especially in schools, that we provide a variety of ways of kids being active. And for some kids, you know, competitive sports is a real off-putting a way to get them active. And we need to be really, you know, there can't be a one-size-fits-all approach.
Sure, and muzzle those parents who are yelling and screaming at their children on the sidelines, which is something for a whole other show. Let me ask you something else, because you mentioned this earlier in the hour, looking at these more indigenous hunter-gatherer societies, which is that activity is a lifelong thing. It's not like you get to be a certain age and then you sort of sit in on your stool for the rest of your life. And I just want to talk about the kind of use it, lose it idea with activity and what happens when people get older. And I'm an older person. I have some aches and pains I didn't have, you know, a number of years ago. I mean, I try to stay active, but sometimes it really hurts.
Yeah. I think that may be the most important. Of all the parts of the book, that's the part I'm really the most proud of, and I feel is the most important part of the book, which is that, you know, humans are really interesting. We evolved, unlike any other animal, we evolved to live after we stop reproducing. Average human hunter-gatherer lives about 2 decades after they stop having kids. And the reason we evolved to live so long is in order to help our children and our grandchildren. And of course, the way that we did that is by being physically active. And so, and that physical activity in turn helps us stay healthy and to live longer, because it, as we talked earlier, it turns on all those repair and maintenance mechanisms that otherwise don't get turned on. So as we get older, the physical activity becomes not less important, it actually becomes more important. And there are plenty of studies, including one that was done here at Harvard, the famous Harvard alumni study by Ralph Paffenbarger. He showed that you know, as Harvard alums were aging, right, because he was able to follow these folks forever, because Harvard's always asking its alumni for money, right? But he got permission to also ask them about their health and find out how they were doing, and he found that as people got older, the benefits of physical activity increased. So somebody who was, you know, spending about 2,000 calories a week exercising, so that's, you know, a moderate amount of exercise, but not a crazy mm-hmm. amount, when they were in their mm-hmm. 20s or 30s, had about a 20% lower rate of mortality. But alums in their 70s who were exercising a fair amount had 50% lower rates of mortality. Wow. And plenty of other studies have shown the same thing. That was the first big study that showed it. And we know the reasons why, because it's, you know, when an older person gets out and goes for a walk, or, you know, you don't have to run marathons, you don't have to do crazy stuff, but just going for a walk or something like that, it, you know, you produce antioxidants, you repair your DNA, you shuttle, you know, metabolites out of your cells, you clean up your cells, you turn on your immune system. I mean, there's tons of evidence that if you want to, like when you get your vaccine, your COVID vaccine, exercising that day actually improves your antibody response and the vaccine is more effective. Exercising helps you deal with respiratory tract infections like COVID. It you produce more of the cells, the cytotoxic T cells and natural killer cells that, and redirects them to your lungs to attack invaders. And I could go on and on and
you
on
could,
and on and
but
on
we
and
can't.
On.
There's
no limit.
There is no limit, but there's a limit to our time on Radio Times. Daniel Lieberman, thank you so much for joining us today on the show.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And the book is called Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.